Hey, Rich Lowry here. If you're like me, you're a last-minute Christmas shopper and a terrible gift wrapper, but let me make this easy for you. You know the gift everyone wants? It's a better night's sleep. Boll & Branch never disappoints with the highest quality sheets, blankets, pillows, and throws. Plus, their holiday packaging makes your gift look and feel special. I got to tell you, Boll & Branch sheets meet my standards, but much more importantly, they've met my wife's standards. Husband and wife team Scott and Missy Tannen founded Boll & Branch to create a new standard in bedding by doing things the right way, not the easy way. Boll & Branch holds themselves to high standards across the board, from sourcing pure organic cotton to putting workers' rights first. And it's not just their sheets that are made the right way. Their pillows, bath towels, and robes are too. So treat yourself and your loved ones to the new standard in bedding from Boll & Branch. Their gifts come wrapped and ready in their special holiday packaging. Order by December 19th for guaranteed delivery by Christmas. The best deals of the year going on right now from December 6th to 8th with promo code EDITORS15 at ballandbranch.com. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com. Promo code EDITORS15. Editors 15, exclusions may apply. Please check it out.
Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Bostonians by Henry James. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. This episode is sponsored by the Subtext Podcast, and I will tell you a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. Our guest is Natalie Taylor, a professor of political science at Skidmore College in New York. She's podcasted with us previously on the works of Henry Adams and Herman Melville, as well as The Portrait of a Lady by Henry James. She joins us by phone as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Natalie, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Oh, thank you, John. I'm really delighted to be here.
Why is The Bostonians by Henry James a great book?
I think it is a great book for a couple of reasons that are maybe atypical of James. So as you mentioned, we've talked about Portrait of a Lady, which is more typical of James's works. By the time he has written The Bostonians, he's already getting a reputation for these international tales. And so when he was asked to think back about The Bostonians and why he wrote it, he explained that he wished to write, and I quote here, a very American tale. He concluded that the best thing to do then would be to write about the situation of women, the decline of the sentiment of sex, and the agitation on their behalf, because he concluded that it was the most salient and peculiar point in their social life at that moment in the late 19th century. And so James takes up the question of woman suffrage as this most salient point. And then I would also say, as a second and pressing theme, is the question of Reconstruction. The novel takes place in the 1870s. And we know that this is in the wake of the Civil War and this real question of whether or not the Union can be stitched back together. It is unusual for James to take up these broad, explicitly political themes. We know that he's really at his best and when he's displaying this remarkable genius he has for portraying his characters' inner lives. And so I think what makes this a really, truly great book is that he's able to offer these a consideration of these large political questions while still doing so by offering us the psychology of his characters. Joseph Conrad had described James as a historian of fine consciousness, and I think we get that in this novel.
We'll talk about all that, the characters, the story. What's American about this book, besides the setting maybe? What it says about women in politics. Is it a work of feminism or not? What it says about Reconstruction and more. Natalie, let's start with the first pages of The Bostonians, this book published in 1886 by Henry James. And here we meet a set of cousins who are about to become rivals. Who are they and how does the story begin?
The story begins in Olive Chancellor's parlor or living room, as we would call it today. And she has invited her southern cousin, he's a Mississippian, Basil Ransom, to visit her in Boston. She has recently learned of his existence and takes it upon herself to welcome him if he should ever be in Boston. And she is, Basil Ransom, as a Mississippian, fought in the Civil War. He owned a plantation that, you know, obviously fell into difficult times following the Civil War, and he and his mother and his sister are barely able to eke out a living. And so he's sort of moved north to try his hand at the law. Olive is sort of drawn to Basil because he does have a rather sad tale, even though he would have fought against, maybe if not, you know, particularly against her brothers. He fought against the Union Army, in which her brothers were killed. But he has a very sort of sad story to tell. And as we learn, mostly from Mrs. Luna, Olive's sister, Olive is always willing to give herself over to the kind of the sad and the suffering. And so she invites him, thinking that it would be an occasion to exercise a kind of familial duty and also to relieve the suffering of a kinsman. And so it's as Basil is waiting for Olive to come downstairs, we learn a lot about the characters from Mrs. Luna, Olive's sister, and also a lot about the Bostonians themselves and what a young man from Mississippi might need to know about the Northern culture.
So with Olive, we have a Boston feminist, and in Basil, we have a Confederate from Mississippi. They're cousins, mm-hmm. but what could possibly go wrong here?
Yeah. Well, and it quickly does. You know, perhaps Olive had the notion that Basil would arrive contrite and having sort of been educated by the Civil War, the errors of Mississippian ways. And it turns out that he is not at all contrite. He is rather proud, and he holds on to a kind of particular conservatism that Olive immediately finds, as she continually calls it, dangerous. Part of that conservatism is a sense that women should be pleasing, that they should remain in the private sphere as a way of making life enjoyable and pleasant, primarily for men.
Now, I just called Olive a feminist. Mm-hmm. Is that the right way to label her? Is that an anachronistic term? In what sense is she a feminist?
Well, so I do think it's maybe anachronistic in the sense that the term comes to us later from the French, but I do think that she in many ways can be described that way and has similar principles and sympathies today than if you know to the women today that we might identify as feminists. So she is already involved in the women's suffrage movement, and she devoted her life to advancing and expanding the rights of women. And I would also say, maybe, and this is another particular way that she has something in common with feminists today that I think James is very clever about, is that she understands women as a class or a category, so that they suffer oppression as a group and as a sex and not necessarily individually. And so although Olive herself lives off of Beacon Street, a little cross street to Beacon Street, and therefore is rather affluent, she is able to maintain a home there and live independently. She has access to travel and books and everything else that would lead what we would today call a very privileged life, that she is a woman subjects her to a certain kind of oppression that all women are subject to.
And Basil, you called a conservative. Is that an anachronistic term? What do you mean by that?
I do offer that label. James himself describes him that way. But I also, knowing our audience and our listeners, want to caution us. We know in the United States that the term conservative can mean a range of things. He is not a classical liberal, right, which is one version of conservatism that we have today where we, you know, in the wake of particularly Reagan administration, where there's a kind of commitment to small government. He's more of a kind of European conservative in that he, you know, comes from this very hierarchical society in antebellum Mississippi. He believes that, as I've already mentioned, human beings have certain limits and certain obligations and places that should be respected. One of the things that we get in this novel that we don't always get from James is a kind of glimpse at his sense of humor. And so when Olive asks Basil, well, don't you care for human progress? Basil quips, I don't know. I've never seen any. Are you going to show me some? You know, and so he just doesn't anticipate that human beings are going to have this kind of progressive improvement in the way that Olive does.
So we've met our two main characters, Olive Chancellor, Basil Ransom, these cousins. There's a third main character. It's kind of a triangle of main characters in this book, and that is Verena Tarrant. Who is she, and how does she enter the story?
She enters pretty quickly after Basil and Olive have their dinner together. Olive tells us that she is going to be going out for the evening to what Mrs. Luna describes as one of her weird meetings. And she's going to this meeting or this gathering of reformers. And so they go to the home of Miss Birdseye, who is a abolitionist, an elderly woman at this point, and they're introduced to Verena there. She is younger than Olive, although, you know, not quite sure. Now, I wouldn't say she's a generation younger, but she is probably significantly younger, at least in spirit. And she has made quite a stir in Boston. She's just returned from the West, and she's able to sort of have this gift of rhetoric and captivating an audience. She takes the opportunity to speak on behalf of women's rights. And so Olive knows immediately that the two must join forces to promote the expansion of women's rights, and that Verena is this lovely mouthpiece for the principles that Olive wants to put forth.
And Basil is also attracted to her. What does he see in her?
I'm not sure either one of these reasons are generous to Basil, but maybe the first is a little bit more generous. I mean, he's just smitten with her. You know, she's winsome in a way that is very attractive. She's physically beautiful. She has this gift of oratory that is captivating. And she's also utterly presumptuous. She is has a certain innocence about her, a kind of candor that's delightful. And so she's just, I think he's attracted to her for, you know, all of these rather lovely reasons, but not for what she's saying. In fact, you know, on occasions when he hears her speak, he can barely remember what she's saying. And he knows that if he did pay attention to the words, he would disagree with her. I would also say that he's kind of willful and very willful. And so there's probably an element of attraction to the thought that maybe he can persuade her otherwise.
So there's a love story here, a kind of romance here, but this is also a book about politics, as you mentioned. It's certainly there in not just the background, it's in the foreground with these questions of women's suffrage and reform and so on. How does James treat this? Is he making a political statement himself in writing The Bostonians?
Perhaps he is, but it's really very nuanced. You know, he is not making a strident claim for women's suffrage. He's also, I don't think, making a strident opposition to Basil, you know, principles about women. I think he is really trying to think through this, as he calls it, the situation of women, and then also the decline of the sentiment of sex. I think that that decline is real to him, and it's a loss that he wants to think about. So I do think his treatment of all the characters are rather nuanced, although Olive is on the side of angels, certainly as we would see today. I mean, even describing Basil's positions, that doesn't go anywhere today. Even though she's on the side of angels, she really has some unattractive qualities, off-putting qualities. And while Basil is his views obviously don't prevail over the long run. He's also very charming, and he also sees something that is important and contributes to it. So one of the things I think is persistent through all of James's works is a real regard for women and a delight in them and a desire to see them sort of flourish. And so so in that respect, I think he would, you know, he's very thoughtful about the ways in which that can happen with the expansion of rights.
He's also poking fun at the reformers, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that Olive does get a little bit of teasing, at least. So one of the things that Olive, not only is she interested in expanding the rights of women, but she really has these democratic sensibilities where she wants to level social differences among women as well. And so the suggestion that maybe she can cultivate the Beacon Street ladies is mildly insulting to her. James tells us that she wished to work in another field. She had long been preoccupied with the romance of the people. She had an immense desire to know intimately some very poor girl. This might be seen one of the most accessible pleasures, but in fact, she had not found it so. It turns out that these very poor girls that she's so anxious to get to know don't see their situation as tragically as Olive does. And so James does poke a little bit of fun at Olive, but I think what he does is show us sort of the complex character of reform and maybe something that we should take into consideration, that a reformer requires, in order to bring about good and perform duty, requires other people to suffer. And so James demonstrates a kind of mixed motivation in each one of the reformers, not only Olive, but Miss Birdseye, others that are around Verena Tarrant, and shows us that the motivations are not pure and that we should be on guard for them.
You're listening to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review, and I'd like to tell you about our sponsor today, which is the Subtext Podcast. Do you love the humanities but not so much a fan of listening to lectures? Then try Subtext Literature and Film Podcast at subtextpodcast.com. In each episode, philosopher Wes Allwyn and poet Aaron Olonik explore life's big questions by way of an in-depth discussion of a great work of fiction, film, drama, or poetry in the tradition of a liberal arts seminar. Subtext focuses on the insights into the human condition that make these texts timeless, insights that can change the way we view ourselves and live our lives. Recent episodes include conversations about the relationship between imagination and ambition in Shakespeare's Macbeth, how to square honor and justice in the film The Godfather, the connection between the political and the spiritual in the short stories of Anton Chekhov, the power of art to preserve in Percy Shelley's poem Ozymandias, and the developmental psychology of magic in The Wizard of Oz. So if you love closed readings of great books and film, go to subtextpodcast.com or search for Subtext on the podcast app of your choice. That's subtextpodcast.com, S-U-B-T-E-X-T podcast.com, or search for Subtext on the podcast app of your choice. Natalie, the title of our book is The Bostonians. That, of course, means the people of Boston. Is that what James is talking about? Is this a work about all the people in the city, or is the title a reference to our main characters who are creatures of Boston themselves?
I think both. There are moments in the novel when James will refer to Olive and Verena and Miss Birdseye as the Bostonians, right? He uses it as a general label for this particular group of women. But there are also ways in which he introduces us to the city of Boston and the sort of particular character of the Bostonians, which these women, you know, also have the same element. So one of the things that the first thing we learn about Olive from Mrs. Luna is that she does not lie. And this is typical, Mrs. Luna tells us, that no one ever fibs in Boston. And so there's kind of an earnestness that we see about that certainly Olive and Verena and Miss Birdseye display, but also that is characteristic of the city and James sometimes contrasts New York to this kind of earnestness that the Bostonians, as a general population, display, but certainly our characters do.
With Basil and Olive, we have a kind of metaphor for mm-hmm. American divisions after the Civil War. We've got this Yankee reformer and this Southern gentleman. And you mentioned this book is partly about Reconstruction. Remind mm-hmm. us, what do we mean when we say Reconstruction, and what does this book have to say about all that?
I think one of the elements that are at work is whether or not the Southern states can really be brought back into the Union according to the principles of the Declaration of Independence, and also, you know, given the politics of the time, to what extent the North would need to intervene in some of the reintroduction of the Southern states, and for how long, and so on. And so, as we talked about, the beginning of the book seems to be about this overture of this Northern woman to invite and show mercy and duty to her Southern rebel cousin. And, you know, he's not as willing as she had kind of hoped he would be. And so one of the, I think, really amazing parts of this novel is the way in which we see Basil and Olive as really very different and opposite of one another, as we've already talked about, but they're really very similar in profound ways. They both apply their sort of general theories to individuals, and as a consequence, they kind of lack discretion that makes the union between them impossible, right? They want to apply their theories to one another and to see each other through the lens of their general theories. And Tocqueville, who James tells us Basil reads, you know, thinks this is distinctive of Americans, that they like to understand social life through these general theories. But and I think this is where James maybe goes beyond Tocqueville. It makes it really very difficult for these two particular individuals to form a union, either in the case of marriage or more broadly in the case of the national government, if you see that as a kind of metaphor. So it really becomes quickly evident that these two are not going to get along in the long run. And so in order to build a union, in politics, you need to have a kind of appreciation for particular circumstances, particular individuals. And I would say that would be true for a marriage as well. And so what we might say then is that the union requires Verena, because she appreciates the complexity of Basil as much as she wishes he would think differently and maybe be brought over to the cause of women's suffrage. She tells him she hopes his ideas are published, and she hopes he doesn't change. And she can be the person who sort of bridges the gap between these two general theories, because she appreciates the particular. And that's what will be needed to bring about political change and to bring the Southern states back into the Union, is to sort of appreciate the differences and make room for those differences.
Is this Henry James's most political work?
Yes, and in the case that we think about, you know, that it's a question of large national questions, I think James is much more of a political writer. If we think about politics in its broadest sense, while he's usually concerned with the sort of marriage plot of an American girl, as we see here, it usually doesn't have the kind of broad national questions at stake. But he's still thinking about how democratic mores are going to inform these sort of smaller decisions. So in that case, I think they're all political, but this is political in a maybe more historical sense. He refers to himself as a historian as he's writing this novel in a couple different places. So he is offering a history of the nation in a more explicit way.
You and I did a show on another great novel by Henry James, The Portrait of a Lady. That's show number 86 in this podcast series. That one's basically about an American girl who goes to Europe and meets European aristocrats, I suppose you might say. Is that book political? And how do we compare it to the Bostonians?
This is such a great question. I don't want to give away any endings to the Portrait of a Lady, because listeners weren't expecting that. But on the face of it, they're very different. As you mentioned, this is a book about the American girl. Verena is an American girl and in a very Jamesian fashion. But it takes place in Boston, whereas Isabel Archer's story takes place in England and in Italy primarily. And the Portrait of a Lady is really much more typical of James's corpus, in which a young American woman is trying to navigate the sort of social practices and conventions of aristocratic Europe, and it's more or less unsuccessfully. And so the question becomes, well, is the American girl more successful on her own soil? It's, one of the elements that I was tempted to think that was true, but in thinking about the comparison between Verena Tarrant and Isabel Archer, I'm tempted to say that they suffer from the same maybe lack of education. And so to your question, is James a sort of proto-feminist writer? I mean, this is maybe some evidence that we might suggest that although both characters have a range of options in marriage or declining marriage, who they'll marry, they both make matches that bring them heartache. So perhaps if they were better prepared for making the choice that their freedom allows, they would have fared better. And so I think that kind of regret on James's part might suggest a political statement, as you had asked me earlier.
I want to ask about how the Bostonians ends. So here's a spoiler alert. If listeners, if you don't want to know how the book ends, turn off the show right now. It's a minor spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But tell us how does it finish with Basil and Verena?
They do marry, and Basil is determined, and eventually Verena decides to leave Olive. She and Olive have been building this career together, but they also have been living together, working tirelessly for the cause, and have been devoted to one another, both professionally and personally. And Verena leaves to marry Basil. And as the novel ends, it's clear that it is not the sort of, you know, carefree, kind of happy excitement that we might expect an eloping couple to experience. James tells us that she has tears in her eyes as she's leaving, and that these are not likely to be the last tears that she'll shed.
Well, let me just read that last line, because
okay,
it is striking. And as you say, this is not happily ever after, apparently. So the final line of the book is this, quote, "But though she was glad, he presently discovered that beneath her hood she was in tears. It is to be feared that within the union, so far from brilliant, into which she was about to enter, these were not the last she was destined to shed," unquote. That's sad, and what does that tell us about the future of America, according to James?
It suggests, and you know, I think certainly in hindsight, we know this to have been true, and we would have been naive to think differently in the 1880s when he's writing this, that the Union, and if we think about, you know, stitching together the Northern and the Confederate states, would be a long, difficult, arduous process, the legacy of slavery we continue to live with today. And so it may be that it's necessary, and it may be the best outcome for America, but it is not without difficulty and problems. You know, if we think about, you know, Verena as the sort of metaphor, she had any number of choices to make in marriage. It wasn't simply a choice between living with Olive and continuing her work, or marrying Basil and being sort of swept away, you know, presumably back to the South or to, you know, some sort of small modest apartment in New York where he would eke out a living. But, you know, she had other alternatives as well that we maybe don't have time to talk about. And so none of them were really great. And so, you know, I think we sort of think back on the Civil War, and if we think about the options that that the United States had at the time, it's not clear that any one of them was an excellent or best choice. And I think we see that with Verena's choice in marriage as well.
Last question as we wrap up. As you say, we still live with the legacy of Reconstruction and sectional division to a certain extent in America today. The women's suffrage debate is over. Congratulations, Natalie. You can vote now. But, you know, but nobody's really debating that. All the questions of feminism are still pertinent. What's the case for reading this book now, almost 150 years later?
I think it gets back to part of our conversation that we've had with respect to, one, the kind of particular character that reformers have, maybe a caution against a kind of certitude or a kind of stridency on the part of reformers, and not just reformers, because as I mentioned, Basil had the same characteristics as Olive. It's just that, you know, he was, as James labeled him, a conservative. So both Olive and Basil have the same either flaws or blind spots that make that it difficult to build a political community out of. You need someone like Verena who is willing to acknowledge a difference, be forgiving of that difference or allow for it in a certain way, who will accept the pleasant. I mean, one of the things that Olive says is that the thing that's wrong with Verena is she doesn't dislike men as a class. If, you know, her problem is if they're pleasant enough to her, she'll like them.
That line reminds me of something Gerald Ford, of all people, said, which is that the problem with the war between the sexes is there's too much sleeping with the enemy.
Well, and that's what allows the relations between men and women to continue, you know. And those, I think, that James really found to be poignant and lovely in a lot of ways and wanted to see them to continue. But that's what's needed in order to stitch together a political community of differences, especially as profound as they are in the 1870s. And so I think that as we live through ways in which our country is polarized along different issues, perhaps, or different iterations of the same issues, then it's really important to keep in mind that lesson that James teaches us.
Natalie Taylor, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Bostonians by Henry James.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks, John.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Please send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.